This is Joshua Gindel. I'm the cellist of the Miro String Quartet.
This is John Largess. I'm the violist of the Miro String Quartet.
Tell us a little bit, before we talk about Beethoven, just the history of the quartet. Where's the name come from?
Yeah, the quartet is named after the Catalan artist Joan Miró, who was a real innovator in the visual art world. And we actually named ourselves after him sort of by accident. We were a young quartet at Oberlin College in Ohio, and we needed a name because we wanted to enter some competitions. I was taking an art history class at the time, and we were learning about Miró and his conception of creating art, which is that you have to be able to imitate the great masters before you, but then when it comes to creating your own art, you need to be a visionary and create from the soul as opposed to imitating what you know. Mm. And I grabbed some prints of Miró because I was so impressed with that idea to bring back to my apartment, and I didn't have time to get to my apartment before our quartet rehearsal started. So I threw them on the table, and one of my colleagues said, you know, what is that? And it was a sort of my literal sophomoric, knowledge of Miró. I explained who he was, and they said, well, why don't we call ourselves the Miró Quartet? Mm-hmm. And there was dead silence in the room, and that was it. We've been the Miró Quartet for 23 years now.
It was a good silence.
Yeah.
Everybody thought it was a stroke of genius.
Well, yeah, and the names that we had come up with prior to that were just terrible.
Right, yeah.
Can you give me a couple examples, just for fun?
Corporate sponsorships down the road.
And favorite products of ours.
Right. Geez, I don't remember the rest, but I do remember those two for some reason.
Yeah, not good choices.
Yeah. So you formed at Oberlin, not too far from where we are here in Toledo. But now you're in Austin. Tell us about your work down there.
So we've been the faculty string quartet in residence at the University of Texas at Austin now for 15 years. And we teach privately there as professors, as well as coordinate and run the string chamber music program there. And we have a concert series at the university. And over the last 15 years, we've really grown to love this community here. It's a wonderful arts community, and it really is our home.
Well, I want to come back and talk a little bit about what you do as far as education and in the community. But let's move on to Beethoven. Mm. Your latest recording is Opus 131. Which is really one of the greatest of the late quartets. I know you've recorded almost all of them, right? You have just, what, three left to go?
Yeah, we're intending to release the entire cycle in 2020, which is Beethoven's 250th anniversary.
And that's your anniversary too, right?
That will be our 25th season together, yeah.
Yeah, it's going to be a big year for Beethoven and for you.
Right, right. And, yeah, no, Opus 131, our most recent album, for Beethoven, even he thought one of his greatest musical accomplishments. It's a through composed work of about 50 minutes, and it's really Beethoven pouring his most intimate thoughts and intimate feelings, and also some circumstantial things surrounding his life at the time into music. And it's really just an extraordinary piece. It took me some time to learn to love the piece, honestly, as a young musician. But as I've gotten older, I feel closer to it every time we play it.
Well, let's tell the story of what was going on in Beethoven's life at this time. I mean, like so many of his works, this is great art that arose from difficulty and circumstances in his life.
Yeah, these last few years of his life, the last two and a half when he wrote the late quartets, were some of the most triumphant and successful years, and also some of the most bitterly disappointing. I mean, he was having professional success with, for example, the Ninth Symphony, Mrs. Solemnis, some of the biggest, greatest, most popular pieces with the largest impact that he had ever written in his life. And this was after 10 years of not being able to write hardly any music at all. So he was feeling this kind of elation that his creativity was back and back in a way better than ever before, maybe. But at the same time, his personal life was had been for the last 10 years and continued to be pretty terrible. He had dreamed about finding love, being married, having a family, and that never happened. Over and over again, relationships didn't work out. And he had been also struggling with this relationship with his nephew and ward, Carl, which really came to a head during the months that he was writing Opus 131. And Carl, actually a week or so after the score was finished to be sent to the publisher, attempted to commit suicide. And luckily he survived and they reconciled afterwards. But there's a lot of, in my opinion, sort of this emotional intensity that's unique to this work, 131, that I think really was Beethoven's way of expressing, dealing, working through this tension. I mean, this was the person he loved perhaps most in his life. And to feel like he's failed them in this way, that's a heavy burden to bear for anybody.
Yeah.
And the music has this kind of final drama to it in the last movement that's really just breathtaking and almost terrifying.
Well, when I think of this relationship between Beethoven and his nephew, and in particular this episode that you describe, it makes me think, you know, perhaps Beethoven had in mind his own flirtation with suicide in the Heiligenstadt Testament, and we know how depressed he was at losing his hearing.
And, you know, it's interesting. I think that the element of depression in his nephew, the element of depression that perhaps Beethoven also had, like there was a family connection there, and having two of them working through that together, in the end, they became quite close in that last few months before he died. But working through it was very, very difficult.
Yeah.
It's also interesting for me. I feel like the piece talks about these very personal things, but in such a universal way, struggling with family and with loss and with our relationships. I mean, this is something that all of us go through. Every person in their lives goes through. And to find the consolation and truth that is in this music that we all can relate to, I think, is what makes this piece so great.
Let's talk about the music itself and what makes it so great. I mean, from the very beginning, you can hear, you can get a sense of what's going on with that fugue that almost has a kind of a spiritual, religious feeling to it as it unfolds.
Yeah, the opening fugue is very mysterious in a way. It has an element of threat to it. It has an element of also consolation and sweetness to it. And for me also, it sort of sums up what it is to be in a quartet, because each of the four voices kind of floats through this space, and we all have our moments to sing or to have our own lines heard or to take up the theme in our own way. I remember playing this once at a house concert, and a friend of ours said, when she listened to the opening fugue, she's like, this is great art. She's like, yeah, I like quartets, but like great art with capital G and capital A. And I was like, wow, there's something really deep about this music that touches people.
Yeah, it gets you right away before it kind of, you know, embarks down a different path as you go along.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you two gentlemen represent sort of the lower half of the quartet, the bass and the bottom and the middle,
right,
so to speak. Can you talk a little bit about how Beethoven treats the cello or the viola? I know he played the viola, and he wrote those incredible cello sonatas. In your experience, does Beethoven treat them differently than other composers that you
Well, the development of the cello, for example, as a solo instrument at that time was really starting to bloom. So you see a lot of great concertos and virtuoso writing by Haydn, his teacher, Boccherini. You know, a lot of the Italians wrote these sort of massive virtuoso concertos. And Beethoven himself had a couple of incredible cellists to write material for, including the cellist who premiered these works. So he wrote the triple concerto, which is one of the most challenging and difficult pieces for the cello in our repertoire. So he starts to use the cello a little more in a more versatile way than his predecessors did, where at times the cello part kind of soars over top of the quartet because he's taking advantage of the fact that the cellists of the time could really play these virtuoso passages up high.
Mm-hmm.
And at times the cello really anchors sort of the emotional heart of the music when the cello gets pulled down to its lowest registers. I think if he had a choice, he would have actually preferred the cello to go down even further. we were talking about that yesterday, actually, in a rehearsal. So it is challenging in that I have to be a little bit manic moving from bass roles to middle voice roles when John, my colleague here, takes the bass line and then into some really high soaring, challenging soloistic moments.
Yeah. Well, you talk about taking the cello high, and Beethoven kind of does some crazy things at the extremes, at the upper extremes of all the instruments.
Yeah. I think that's true. And I think one of the hallmarks of the late quartets is that here's a master who knows both the colors of every register of all the instruments, even maybe the slightly different colors between the register of the second violin and the first violin. And he also knows emotionally what impact moving tunes and material into these registers will have. And he really can exploit them in a way I don't think anybody before him had done, to create this wide palette of emotion in the colors of the sound. It's just amazing.
Do you think that his deafness, I mean, he was totally deaf by the time he wrote this, gave him a sense of freedom when it came to writing for this genre?
I mean, I think that's true. I think, you know, he definitely used his imagination to its fullest and didn't allow any there's a famous story of Ignaz Schuppanzich, whose quartet premiered almost all these pieces, and he was working in one of the late quartets with Beethoven in the rehearsal, watching. He couldn't hear it, but he was watching what they were doing. And Schuppanzich complained about some awkward violin passage, and Beethoven said, "What do I care about your puny fiddle when the spirit of creation possesses me?" And you could be like, yeah, well, maybe if he wasn't deaf, he would have felt the same way. He would be like, do it anyway. That's what I want you to do. Yeah. But that's also part of the heroic quality of the music, is that even today, 250 years later, these pieces are challenging. They're not easy. They're not always intuitive. And they demand something from us as the performers, emotionally and also technically, to really dig. And I think that's what makes them great, great, great pieces.
Well, you really hit on what I wanted to ask you next, which was, you know, so many quartets have played this music. How does Miro Quartet put their own stamp on it? How do you make it your own?
I think that, you know, every quartet feels like they bring a unique voice. You can probably tell by this interview that there's some strong personalities in our ensemble.
Yeah.
And two of them aren't even represented right now.
Right.
So we all have really strong ideas of how this music should go. And it's the amalgam of the four of our personalities that I think make it different. And we definitely get the feedback that when we play these works, that we show more of the score, and we're able to kind of dig a little deeper, and that you really hear the complexity of the music as opposed to making it too homogenous. Alongside that, we have a unique opportunity that allows us to actually distribute this music differently, which is that we give the music away for free. So that in its own right is different. You can go to our website, miroquartet.com, and download this album entirely for free until May 1st. And then everything we recorded prior to this, including all of the other Beethoven quartets that we've released, are available to stream there. We want this music to be heard. We clearly believe in it and believe in the power of it. And, you know, we want to do anything we can to allow people access to it.
Cellist Joshua Gindel and violist John Largesse, two members of the Miro Quartet. Gentlemen, I want to thank you for talking to us here on FM 91. Best of luck with this new recording. Also, you can get that recording as a free download on their website at Miro Quartet, that's M-I-R-O, quartet.com, until May 1st, Beethoven String Quartet number 14, Opus 131. Again, Joshua and John, thanks for joining us today here on FM 91.
Been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much.